Andre Previn was quoted once as saying that John Williams was the only guitarist he'd ever heard who never made a mistake. But technical perfection is just one of the factors. To it must be added that indefinable word, I think it's artistry, or is it musicality, which transports us, the listeners, into another realm. John Williams. Spoke too soon, that last chord. Music by Barrios.
Barrios Mangorey.
And it's called Una... I can't say the Spanish, you do it.
Yeah, it was known for many years as the last song, La Última Canción, because it was the last piece that he wrote. But its full title is Una Limosna por el Amor de Dios.
The love of God, presumably.
An alm or a gift for the love of God. And it's very interesting, the little accompanying figure in the bass, apparently one of his disciples has related this, was suggested by the tapping of a blind man's stick, and it's something that that beggars and people say in Latin American countries is an arm in begging, an arm for the love of God.
I see.
So that's what suggested the piece to him. Yeah.
Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you, Mike.
I was saying it's a bit overdue. We've tried a couple of times when you've been in Australia to pin you down, but it's been very hard to get your diary to agree with ours.
I know. Well, it's usually, you know, other people organising my diary. I've been trying to.
Do you hate other people organising your time? Is that part of the... Does that go with the territory?
No, I mean, on a tour, when I'm on a visit, that's when I'm in London at home, I do everything myself. I have an agent, but I mean, I decide exactly everything and that I don't do too much. But, you know, on a trip when you're touring, you have to, and especially up in Darwin, where we've tried to get together to do something. I love it going there for the guitar festival, and I basically say to them, look, fill every gap, stick me in there, and let me do everything, you know, and of course it ends up too much sometimes, but I actually like it.
Congratulations on the doctorate.
Thank you.
Yes, Tell me about that. That was awarded to you from the University of Melbourne.
It was, yes. They first, I think it was suggested, had the idea a year or two ago, and then it was a question of waiting till I was out to receive it. So it was really a great honour.
Does it mean a lot to you?
Well, it does in a funny sort of way. I mean, for two reasons. I mean, I have a few sort of honorary degrees from music colleges and things, which, you know, also nice to have, especially since I never earned any. I wasn't bright enough to earn any, so
debatable.
I got the honorary ones.
Of course you earned it. You earned it in a different route from
well,
the
that's
purely
very
academic
nice of you
route.
To put it like that. But the other thing is that, in a way, it is, I have to say, particularly nice that it's, obviously, that it's Australian, and particularly from Melbourne hometown, because I'm not really a sort of patriotic person. I mean, in the sense that, in my attitude to society and the world and the way I live, and it causes so much trouble, people's false sense of pride to do with, I have to say it, religion as well as country. And but nevertheless, I am an Australian living in London, and I do actually feel more Australian than London. So there are those little twinges come back, and I think, well, I am actually, you know, actually proud in a way to be Australian. I don't know if it's because I am Australian originally. I think I do actually like the Australian character. I like those characteristics, whether I've inherited any, I suppose, is another point. But I like the openness. I like the ability to see through nonsense and hypocrisy and that sort of thing. And England is still, although it's changing quickly, which is very good now, but it's still a class-ridden country by tradition. And Australians see through that very, very well. And in that way, I feel very Australian. So, you know, the doctorate, although it's not strictly related to that, the fact that it is in hometown, and especially being here for the festival, you know, being here for two weeks, I've got an opportunity to be back here for longer than just a couple of days. Yeah. So it all fits in.
During the course of these interviews, I always like to ask people about their origins, and I'd like to do that with you now. I know that there will be a lot of guitar players listening to this conversation wanting me to ask you all those terrible questions about how you do it and all of that, and I'll do that in a moment.
Fingernails.
Fingernails and a lot of dexterity. But let's talk about Melbourne, because although you say you feel Australian and all of that, a couple of comments could be made. One is that you belong to an international organisation which is called Music, which knows no barriers.
Right, yes.
Another is that, in fact, there is English blood in your veins. Your father was English, but your mother was an interesting character, wasn't she?
Mother, I have to, a most amazing coincidence, I have to say. When I was receiving the doctorate, I don't know which order to put this in, but perhaps I should talk about my mother first. Mm-hmm. My mother was half Chinese mm-hmm. from a father's side of the family. He was a very famous Melbourne barrister called Willie Arquette. That's right.
Yes.
But extraordinary coincidence, you know, the other day, the Chancellor of the university, when we had the ceremony and I had the doctorate, was awarded the honorary doctorate, he is a judge, Edward Woodward, and he actually for 20 years had, as a junior, I think must have been, he had Willie Arquette's gowns.
Go on.
Isn't that amazing coincidence?
That is amazing.
And he had them for 20 years.
Really?
Before he passed them on, you know. And he obviously knew from the biography that Willie Arquette was my grandfather.
Was your grandfather.
Yeah, who I never knew, because he died in 39 and I wasn't born until 41.
Your mother, however, was half Chinese, as
yes,
his daughter.
Right.
Did she keep alive your Chinese heritage for you?
No, I think that generation of... And that goes back to Willie Arquette. You know, he was sort of... 1860s born, I suppose, roughly, in Australia. And I think he was brought up by... I think his parents might have died, so I'm not sure of the family history, but I think the you know, there were a lot of persecution of Chinese all around Australia then, for various reasons, but certainly he really made it, you know, I mean, in spades, you know, being a barrister and very, very major one. And he represented the Australian Chinese in Sun Yat-sen's Republican government for the overseas delegates, things like that. You know, he was a very... And I think the motive or the urge in the successful Chinese families of that generation was to really become as integrated in the local community and not to separate themselves. So there was no Chinese spoken by the children, you know.
Did your mother look Chinese?
She did, yes, she looked. They all looked obviously a bit Chinese. He didn't look Chinese in terms of typical characters. I mean, he's obviously Chinese, but he didn't look like your cartoon character of a Chinese. In other words, your typical, very Chinese-looking Chinese, you know. Not on the photographs I've seen, anyway.
Yeah.
But I mean, he was Chinese. So the children looked half Chinese, but no more than half. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Your father, Len, guitarist himself, and your first teacher and all of that, you came into the studio today telling me about a story about some monkeys in
that.
Now, there is a connection here. There's no accident that you're interested in monkeys.
That's right. Well, I read this extraordinary story in the newspaper just before coming along here this morning. In fact, anyone can look it up in The Age this morning.
Yeah.
It's about 60 gorillas that went into a little village in the Cameroons, in Africa, in Cameroon. Sorry, not the Cameroons. And... looking for an infant which a hunter had taken from their gorilla group. And they went to this village and then left, making a big noise and banging on doors and windows, and a lot of the local people were frightened. Well, they didn't do any damage or harm anyone. They came back the next night, and the chief or representative in the village realized what they were looking for and insisted that the hunter give this baby gorilla back
to
them.
So he hadn't shot it dead? He'd kept it.
He'd been going to send it to a zoo or something. They gave it back. The gorillas came back the next night, and they gave it back, and the gorillas left town.
How fantastic. What a
lovely story. Well, my father,
had a great, well, not just a passing interest. He had a great interest, didn't
basically,
he?
If you like, a change of life. In his mid-40s, age of 50, he didn't give up music as a lover of music and playing at home, but he gave up teaching, gave up his guitar school in London. And he moved down to Cornwall in England, and he'd always loved animals. In fact, the last year he spent in Melbourne, before we went back to London, he was working at Melbourne Zoo.
Sloshing hippopotamuses.
Yes, how do you know? Amazing, you know. It's true, yes.
I've kept an eye on you over the years, John. So,
and he went and he founded a sanctuary for Humboldt's woolly mammoth. Humboldt was a great explorer who, I think, explored the Amazon a lot. He probably actually shot a lot of animals too, which is probably rather horrible. But there was Humboldt's woolly monkey is the most beautiful New World monkey from the Amazon, a threatened species. And my father started this colony, the sanctuary, which he died 10 years ago, but the colony is a self-sufficient, thriving community of people who run and keep these beautiful monkeys in a sort of semi-captivity. It is captivity, it has to be for their own safety, but wonderful grounds.
Yeah.
And they are in the process of trying to re-release back into selected areas.
Mm. Do you think your father instilled in you a love of nature that followed you through?
I think, you know, I'm very affected by, influenced by my father's attitudes on a whole range of things. I've been brought up in a political family to start with. Mm. You know, they were sort of 30s coffee,
radicals,
jazz, heavy smoking left intellectuals. You know, that was the generation. Although I went my own way a little bit, because when I was very young, I got very interested in the peace movement. That's when I joined and supported a campaign for nuclear disarmament.
Mm.
And now in London, I'm still president of MANA, which is the Musicians Against Nuclear Arms. It's a little bit redundant, I have to say, in terms of political activity nowadays, because the world has changed a lot and there are different priorities, and a lot of the things that we were arguing for have already happened.
Mm.
And it's still relevant, but you know, there's so many other problems as well. But generally, my father was a great influence on me. His attitude to life and, as you mentioned, like animals and wildlife, and really what makes behaviour, what has gone in evolution towards what our behaviour is and how we organise and relate to ourselves.
Yes.
I think it's very important, and just as a hobby, very interesting to look back at animals and the variety of ways in which they behave.
Mm. Let's hear some more music. Now we get onto the list that you asked for. Right. We've had our little indulgence. That you've chosen Alicia de la Rocha to play something. Tell us what it is.
Well, it's El Puerto from Iberia, a suite of piano pieces by Albéniz, Spanish composer and pianist. It's just that her playing of Spanish music, in fact, I did a lot of my first arrangements of Granados, another great Spanish composer, when I heard her back in 1960s. I heard her playing some other music, but it's just that the way she plays Spanish music as a Spanish pianist, which she is, it's a great guide for us guitarists. Thank you.
The pianist Alicia Della Rocha and El Puerto by Albéniz. Do you say with a zzz on the
Albéniz,
end?
Albéniz, well, Albéniz. It depends what part of Spain one isn't from, doesn't it?
I never know.
I never know.
Yes, exactly. John Williams chose that. You said it teaches guitarists something to listen to that?
I think she has links going back a long way to Granada's. I think she learnt originally from a pupil of Granada's or something. Mm. I don't know.
But what can a guitarist learn from a pianist?
I don't think it's so much the piano, actually, although the dynamics help, you know, the fact that it's just that someone who's in that tradition of music, so steeped in that tradition, it helps to get away from the... As guitarists, we tend to be trapped by our own little formulas and habits, you know, so that we do all the little tricks on the guitar and they can start to take over.
Yes.
And not actually express what the piece of music or the composers or the picture, the description of the... I mean, a famous example on guitar is a piece called Sevilla, mm-hmm. which is by Albéniz, and it's based on the dance of the Sevillanas, and clearly it needs to sound like a Sevillanas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And often we've got a habit which has been passed on really through Segovia and, you know, the great Spanish guitarist, who nevertheless took great liberties with the original sort of inspiration of these pieces. So it when you go back to hearing someone play it on the piano, it gives you more of an idea of what the original was.
Yeah. Is it the shadow of Spain that looks over your shoulder all the time, or is it the shadow, you guitarists,
right.
plural, or is it the shadow of Segovia? Is it because he was Spanish that...
I think we're well past that now. I think it has done for years, and of course it still does within Spanish music.
Mm.
But I think what's important on the guitar is that the relevance of the guitar to Spanish music is really the music of Andalusia and flamenco, because the guitar is actually not the natural instrument of the rest of Spanish music. You've got wind instruments, you've got the
yes.
sort of bagpipes in the northwest Galicia, you've got all those wonderful street instruments in Catalonia. So the guitar really is in the music of Andalusia and flamenco, and that is terrific. But there are kind of traditions that have been followed by minor Spanish composers. I won't mention the names because it seems ungentlemanly of me. And through Segovia as well, which have rather limited the way we play the guitar, because the guitar now is really not a Spanish instrument. It's a universal instrument.
Well, it's been taken up and composed for by numerous nationalities.
Exactly.
But I'm just wondering that the guitar presumably existed in times ancient, across southern Europe, surely, did it?
Exactly, yes. I mean, it did, and probably originally came from a mixture of instruments through the Greeks and the Romans into Europe, but also through the Arabic nations, through the Moors, the Oud, and all those wonderful sort of East Mediterranean and Middle Eastern, North African instruments, you know.
So the question remains then is, was it because of Segovia's dominance that it became this sort of constant concentration of Spain?
I think so. And I think that the early 19th century had a sort of golden era of guitar where it was Italy, France and Spain had their guitar virtuosos, rather like Paganini on the
yes.
violin. And that created a vast amateur guitar playing public. And Segovia sort of developed that late 19th century thing into a concert public of people who love the instrument. And I think that amateur, which is wonderful, I'm not at all criticising the amateur aspect of it, but that came to be to infect the professional aspirations that Segovia had. And they were still sidelined, the guitar was still sidelined from the mainstream of music. Now, this has come full circle now, which is what I'm particularly interested in, because I think the mainstream of classical music is in itself the writings on the wall here, you know. It's not facing up to, it, but it's in the middle of having to face up to, but only being dragged by its coattails, to the fact that West European or Central European classical music is not the most important music in the world.
There are wicked incursions from elsewhere.
There are wicked incursions, and they all have long traditions going back thousands of years, which put our European classical music in context as one of three, four, five musical cultures of the world.
Yes.
And it's great, but it's not the one progressive great sum total of music. And
yeah, so it's up to audiences to accept that, but it's also up to people like yourself, and you have done that. I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, exploring other areas.
I just get inspired by the things I hear. It often looks as if I'm trying to knock down barriers and all that, and I appreciate the implied compliment when it comes. I take it as a compliment, but I really don't set out to do that, because I'm a great believer that social pressures and cultures, they provide their own change. And it's a question of not resisting them and going with them.
Although Segovia himself wasn't too thrilled, was he, back when you...
Well, I have to say that, you know, we're going to look back on Segovia as a part of history, a wonderful part of giving the guitar, and especially the sound of the guitar, a great respectability in the best sense, sensitivity and respectability. But that's where it stops, because in terms of musical development, he was a bit of a break. Someone like... The composer of the first piece that you played, that I was playing, Agustin Barrios Mangarez. He was a great early 20th century Paraguayan guitarist. He wrote hundreds of pieces, a wonderful player, but not in this very precious European style that Segovia had developed.
I remember you met way back Alirio Diaz, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Venezuelan, if I'm not wrong.
Oh, wonderful. And still alive, of course.
And is he still making
and
music?
And playing just as fast as ever. We always joke about it. Really? Yes, absolutely. In fact, it's very interesting that Clifford Hocking, you know, who's obviously the director of the festival, Melbourne Festival here now, he was the first person to ever bring Alirio Diaz to Australia.
Is that
20,
so?
30 years ago, yes.
I remember gosh. As I said, guitarists will be listening saying, Margaret, why don't you ask him this, that and the other? I'm not qualified because I don't play the guitar. But
then you're more qualified than anyone.
Do you think? Yes. Well, it strikes me then, because I used to fiddle on the piano, and and pianists have the benefit of having, you know, these two distinct parts of the keyboard to make music from. Right. But with a guitar, you've got the one hand plucking and the one hand with the strings. Yep. And so much of the music requires two voices, doesn't it? Or three more. Is this where the technical precision becomes vital?
Oh, it's a big subject, that. I think it all depends. I mean, you can keep a sort of three-part Bach fugue going on the guitar and the different parts. And, of course, you've got the six strings. When it comes to ordinary harmonies, you've got many more notes. Mm-hmm. I think it's everything. I think the main thing with the guitar compared, for example, with the piano, would be the same as comparing the violin and the piano, is that you have to make the note. You have to actually make the note. So in a sense, you finger the note and then you pluck the string. So it's two coordinated actions in order to play one note. Mm. It's not already made for you. So I think that's the qualitative difference.
Yes.
In playing
is technical brilliance for which you're renowned? Mm. I mean, I suppose people go on about it and it might irritate you a bit, but is that achieved simply by practice and practice and practice and practice?
It's by listening. You see, I think one of the big problems with guitars, it's difficult, but then any instrument is difficult. So guitarists have got this sort of idea in their head that it's more difficult than any other instruments. It's not. It's just that we're often called upon to play too many notes. You know, note for note, it's no more difficult than any other instrument. But I think, you know, it's listening to the sound you're making and have that sound come out like you feel it and want it. That is technique, not speed. There are many guitarists that play faster than me, faster than Julian Bream. I mean, Julian Bream and I often used to joke about this. You know, we'd start on some difficult guitar duo.
See who could finish first.
And then, we both knew neither of us could, because we'd compare ourselves to some well-known duo, you know, and we say, you know, my God, you know, we can't play anything like them. But we weren't being cocky about it when we did that. The problem is that just playing fast doesn't mean anything.
Absolutely.
You know, rhythm is, I mean, there's rhythm, there's sense of movement and heart and all that. But that is technique. See, technique is the control, in the best sense, of sound. If you want to make a beautiful sound in a very beautiful romantic piece, then being able to bring out certain three notes with a very lovely sound in the middle of a harmonic texture,
yes,
and on a particular string that you've got time to do the nice little glissando that gives it a bit of expression.
Mm.
That is technique, being able to do that.
And being able to know when it won't tip over into being sentimental or so.
Oh, exactly.
Well, I mean, if you, as an example, a piece of music that everybody knows, the famous slow movement of the Rodrigo.
That's right, yes.
The pace at which that goes, those opening things, is crucial to the whole
movement,
isn't it?
Actually, yes. In fact, funnily enough, it's that's the conductor's job too, and you know, and conductors that can keep a lovely steady tempo throughout.
But it's
that
you
moment.
That opens it, isn't it? Isn't it a solo opening to
You're
that
right.
moment?
You're right. Well, I play the chords.
Yes.
The guitarist plays the chords, and then the coronglé comes
yeah.
in,
and it's up to him or her to keep the.
No, no, that's right. But the guitar does establish the chords and the tempo. That's right. But what you often find is that once that's done. A conductor, because of all the other things that happen, the tempo starts to wander a bit, which when it's slow, it's okay. I mean, it's together. But that lovely slow pulse can go. And that's the difference, actually, between popular music, pop music, rock music, jazz, and classical music.
Mm.
And classical conductors, not all of them, some of them fall into that trap. I call it a trap. They would think it's musical, of following the soloist. So the beat... You know, the lovely pizzicatos
and the bass. But I thought you were just saying that you set the pace, for instance, in that Rodrigo.
Yeah, but having set it, you're having set the pace with the chords, that pulse has to continue while the guitar plays the tune. But the guitar plays the tune over a pulse. And the pulse has to be even.
And
you can't stop and
you're...
start the beat following what the... Classical music is based very much on everything being subservient to whoever the featured artist is. So that everything has to fit into that. So if you get a thing, well, I haven't got a guitar here to show you, but, you know,
da-da-dun-dun-dun-dun-da-da-dum. Yeah.
The pulse should be the same wherever those melodic notes land. Like when a jazz player, the bass and drums is going on, whether it's slow or fast, in the same tempo, what the soloist is eloquently improvising on comes over the top of that.
If you hear
Cleo Lane sing, you know, you'd never hear her main syllables and words and that...
On the beat.
Never on the beat.
Yes,
but the beat is constant. Classical music doesn't quite understand that yet, but it will soon.
Even if it takes you all your life to
That's right.
It. Berlioz, please.
Berlioz. Oh, do you know, when I was first introduced to this by the pianist Fu Tsong, great pianist... A very old friend of mine who I haven't seen for a long time now, in about 1969. And when I first had it, I used to stay up at 4 o'clock in the morning listening to the whole thing. It's 5 hours.
Yeah.
we're not going to hear it
we'll
now.
We'll hear 5 minutes, right.
So I hope no one complains about only having the excerpt. But the Trojans, I mean, it's got everything into it. I don't think we've got time to talk too much about the Trojans, have we?
We'll talk about it in a moment. Let's hear the music, then we'll
talk
about it.
Right.
Thank you.
The voice of Berit Lindholm singing the role of Cassandra from The Trojans by Berlioz from Act One. Sir Colin Davis conducting and chosen by our guest John Williams. What was she singing there? What was that all about?
Well, it's the beginning of the opera, actually, and she's rich, as I said, last 5 hours. she's warning. She goes on to warn about, after all the victory celebrations, that the Greeks are all dancing around, but in fact the Trojans, something awful is about to happen. That thereby, we always say, Cassandra, you know, someone who's foretelling the future and all that. And that's her big aria of saying, you know, here they are. She's feeling sad because she knows this is inevitable, because she can see that they don't, they've got lost in their own revelries of and not taking care of what's going to happen. But it's I get rather sick of opera plots. I mean, I think they're all sort of so silly, and I can never add up the wonderful music that comes from Mozart and different people like that with the awful silly, what I think of the silly plots mostly. And this is a great exception because it's a great historical drama, and yes. Berlioz wrote the libretto after the Virgil, you know, whole thing. And it's just wonderful, like the great love duet of the whole centrepiece of the whole thing ends with this century, instead of the sort of triumphant or lovely big sort of ending of the duet, ends up with a century very menacingly singing Italie, Italie, meaning the destiny is to go on and found Rome and be Italy. You know, so it's always, everything is always being pushed forward to what's going to happen next. It's a very, very dramatic piece. Yeah.
John Williams is our guest. John, I don't know whether you've found, once you passed your 50th birthday, that you started thinking differently about life, or I mean, I, a lot of my friends who reach that, you know, interesting half century start to talk about their, you know, reflecting on how they got to where they are and what the rest of their life might contain.
Right.
And I wonder about you, because you've had a fascinating life in music, and you've referred briefly to that really rather unusual childhood in St Kilda.
Right.
How do you think that affected you, that household in which you grew up? Do you think it lastingly affected you?
Oh, I think definitely the way I was brought up and the values that go with it, it is me. I find it very difficult to... I wouldn't want to escape from it, but, you know, life is full of compromises, you know, so you have to some extent.
Mm. Had your father not been a guitarist, would you have found the guitar, do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I used to say, I had a period in my 20s when I used to think to myself, you know, I'm really lucky. I'm so lucky and I really like what I do. I kind of would have liked to have chosen to do it. Not that he made me, but all the pressures and all the persuasion was that I should do, you know, I was going to be a guitarist. And it might have been nice if I'd been an ordinary kid, you know, and decided what I want to do and chosen to do the guitar. Mm. So I used to think that would be nice until I had the obvious thought, I might have chosen the wrong thing. A lot of people do. So it's redundant to think what choice you might have had. You go with what you've got, and I'm so pleased. I mean, I can't say so pleased, it's a terrible understatement, but I mean, I just couldn't have been luckier because
I
love
it. People talk about finding your voice, don't they?
Right,
and they might try one instrument and then realise that they all the time wanted to be a cellist or whatever.
That's right. Mm. I think music teaching, I think again, it's part of a wider subject as to what classical music teaching is. And I'm very interested in that, and I'm president of the EGTA, which is the European Guitar Teachers Association, so I take a great interest in the whole development of teaching. And I think it's a great tragedy. A lot of kids in sort of Western-oriented society have been put off music by being forced to, you know, practice their instrument in a cold room in the house, you know, little, you know, Emily, go and have your little piano lessons and practice on your own in the cold, etc., etc. And how you get round that, I'm not quite sure. Certainly popular music gets round it, because you don't have to have those sort of artificial skills learnt at an early age. You can take up guitar or drums or something at any time, more or less, and you can play, you know, even reasonably good folk and traditional music that way. But with classical music, unfortunately, you do have to have an early age.
So that's the problem. And a lot of parents listening to this will relate to that, because they know that the child has to practice. You understand that as an adult.
I think the important thing is that it has to be explained. There has to be music in the household, you know, through one or both of the parents. And the child, it has to be explained to the child, you know, you really don't have to practice. And you have to understand that you only have to practice if you want to be, if you really love it. And if you don't, then don't.
Yes.
You know? I mean, I know so many people, grown up and children, and I won't mention any particular names, who I regard as far more musical than a lot of practicing musicians.
Do you?
Yeah, listeners, people who simply love it, they react to things that I think have got extraordinarily lovely, innate, instinctive taste. They react to it, they love it. And I know several music critics, you know, I say, who have not the anything like the musicality that these people have. You know, so it's a very big subject, this.
You've struck me always as being a gregarious animal. You like playing with other musicians, don't you?
And
you
very
like,
much.
And I remember you once telling me about a wonderful lifestyle that you seem to have developed, which also perhaps is a reflection of the childhood.
Well, I'm able to like spend 9 or 10 months at home of the year in London without travelling a lot, except to places that I particularly want to go to, you know, and to not do too many or even very many solo concerts on my own. I do about 12 or 15 a year, no more than that. But the rest of my time, when I can, I mean, this visit to Melbourne is wonderful because I'm getting an opportunity to play with the Scamper Quartet tomorrow and also playing with the orchestra next week. So I'm in one place, mixing, seeing people, going to other events, meeting other musicians and having the opportunity to play with them. And that's kind of what I do in London all the time. You know, what I'm doing here in Melbourne these 2 weeks is kind of how I live in London.
And the house seems to be open and people come and
yes, we've got a quite an open house. We have, you know, family in and around and that sort of thing. So I'm lucky enough to be able to do that. I mean, I could earn 10 times more than that if I was on the road all the time, but, you don't need to do that.
Do you want to?
And why?
Yeah, exactly. You know. Tell us about this piece of music, please. Philip Horton it is.
Yes, well, Philip is a wonderful composer, like a lot of creative people. He finds it difficult to be consistently, you know, creative, writing masterpieces all the time, and he sometimes prefers to go off and do different things, but he's a really wonderful... He's a guitarist from Melbourne, and he plays a lot of music that we play. I've recorded some duos with Timothy Kane from Canberra. We've done... we've actually done an album of duos, and including three lovely pieces of Philip for two guitars. One of the most evocative pieces that I've ever heard, actually, and certainly from him, in fact, he's probably the only person that could have written a piece like this, is a piece called Light on the Edge, which he originally commissioned in its original form, which is slightly different, for Darwin International Guitar Festival a few years ago, and has been recorded again by Marion Shapp and Peter Constant and their friends. And it's wonderful. It's got zither and harp and prepared tape and didgeridoo. Wonderful. Charlie McMahon playing the didgeridoo and wonderfully integrated into the sounds of the guitar. And I'd like to hear a lot more music like this.
Thank you.
Charlie McMahon on didgeridoo, with Philip Horton playing zither on that, and another small group of musicians, a piece by Philip Horton called From the Light on the Edge, and chosen by John Williams. It's amazing what an effect the didgeridoo has on to music.
It's a wonderful instrument,
yeah.
Isn't it? Yeah.
Can you play any other instrument beside guitar?
No, I can fiddle around on the piano because I use that for arranging, but that's all I can do. Yeah.
Mm. Are you still interested in exploring all these different kinds of music that are coming now, more and more available on CDs and things like that?
I am, yes. I mean, the thing I'm now really interested in doing, it's going to take at least a year, it's a project which I'm working with the record company on. I mean, it's not a commercial, it's emanated from me, but it needs a lot of backup from the record company because of the getting together with the people concerned, is to do basically an African record.
Yes.
Because the African, the Spanish guitar, the classical guitar is actually used all over Africa. And it's in the last 100 years, it's become a traditional instrument, not just in popular music. And so they use it in their own traditional music, you know. And a lot of it, this Francis Bebe, who I know has been out here with the WOMAD organisation, he's going to be working on it a little bit with me, because he'll be quite a good help, you know, arranging and guiding me to the different things. But I've got a whole stack of records to listen to.
Oh,
and there's a wonderful, wonderful singer called Wes from Cameroon. He lives in Paris. He's got just one of those voices. It's fantastic. And apparently he's already said he'll do a little piece on the record I do, you know. So if I can get enough credibility that people, you know I really...
Well, you'll have to work on that, John. You've got no credibility whatsoever.
Exactly. But, these things come up. It's a question of selecting what things you can actually responsibly do well enough, you know, that are not just a kind of indulgence, you know, because of your own interest. But I'm sure with guitar, it's so endemic, actually, in African music that it should be done and can be done, and I would love to do it.
Well, it's terrific to see you at last.
Well, lovely to see you again,
Michael. Another concert tomorrow night. I'll give details of the concerts a bit later, because I want to play as much of this last piece of music as possible. It's Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton.
Friend of yours?
Lovely. I'd love to call him a friend. I know him quite well. Yes, we don't see each other often. We run into each other in music shops and lifts and hotels every night. Layla, which is one of the great sort of classics of the 60s, early 70s. But this has got one of the great key changes ever. And it's got terrific, all his personal dynamism, which it was then and still is.
Lovely to see you, John Williams, and this is Eric Clapton. That key change, that's Eric Clapton, and one of the classic pieces from the 60s called Layla that he wrote. Now, let me just tell you, if you're in Melbourne and you can secure a ticket, John Williams will be giving a chamber music gala with the Scamper Quartet and the forte pianist Melvin Tan tomorrow night at the Melbourne Town Hall. And then the concert after that is with the Melbourne Symphony, an exclusive to Melbourne type concert, Surveying the Century. So that's John Williams playing music with by Ross Edwards, Peter Sculthorpe and others. That's on Wednesday of next week, the 29th. You're with us on ABC Classic FM. It's come around to news time. ¶¶
ABC National News with John Roden. Three Democrat senators have thrown their hats into the ring to stand as parliamentary leader following Cheryl Curnow's switch to Labour. The acting leader, Meg Lees, Lynn Allison and Andrew Murray will contest the ballot next month, with the final result expected to be announced on December the 5th. Senators Natasha Stott-Despoja and John Woodley have nominated for the job of deputy leader. Senator Lees says she consulted her two daughters before deciding whether to stand.
Yes, they were quite enthusiastic, a little bit concerned about some of the privacy implications for them, but very supportive of me going ahead with the nomination.
Sellers have moved in on the Australian share market as investor confidence continues to be shaken on stock markets around the world. Finance reporter Adrian Thirsk says the Australian, New Zealand and Japanese markets have all opened significantly lower this morning.
As the fallout continues from yesterday's crash in Hong Kong, the Australian share market has succumbed for a second day. A short time ago, the main market indicator, the All Ordinaries Index, was down 73 points to 2,542. The New Zealand market is now almost 6% lower, while the Japanese market dropped 1.3% in the first 5 minutes before recovering. Broker at Burdett, Buckridge and Young, Ian Schlapelius, says the critical moment for the local market will be the reopening of Hong Kong.
But at the moment it's fairly sombre, market's down 2.8%. I think it's going to stay a little quiet until we see the opening of the Asian markets, and in particular Hong Kong at lunchtime.
The Prime Minister, John Howard, says Australia will accept a mandatory greenhouse gas emission target at the forthcoming global conference in Kyoto, provided it's fair. But he's rejected the suggestion that Australia is isolated on its greenhouse stand. Matt Peacock reports from the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, due to begin tomorrow in Edinburgh.
Mr Howard says it's quite wrong to suggest his discussions with British Prime Minister Tony Blair on the greenhouse issue were difficult, describing the talks as cooperative and constructive. And he says Australia will accept a mandatory target for emissions.
We can't have a free ride. Australia will have to do more. I make that clear to the Australian public in the years ahead to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. What I am determined to do is to ensure that my country is not burdened with an unfair proportion of the load, and what President Clinton has done gives me great encouragement.
The Prime Minister says US President Clinton's greenhouse proposals are a vindication of Australia's campaign for differentiation on national greenhouse targets. Matt Peacock, Edinburgh.
The Federal Primary Industries Minister, John Anderson, says a new business program will be launched next year to help farmers with finance and training skills. Mr Anderson told a business conference in Sydney today the FarmBiz program will replace the Rural Adjustment Scheme from next July. He says the new service will allow farmers easier access to financial assistance and provide up-to-date technology and job skills training.
Like doctors and lawyers and everybody else in this hard-pressed and very competitive age, it's all about continual skills enhancing and picking up new abilities and new knowledge. It's a cutthroat world out there for farmers, as I know very well and as farmers know. This is a package designed to give them the same opportunities that other professionals have.
Pauline Hanson says she'll field One Nation Party candidates in the next Queensland election. She says she's changed her mind in the last fortnight from the previous policy that she would concentrate only on the federal arena. Ms Hanson says her change of heart is in response to a demand for state One Nation politicians.
I'm looking at standing candidates in the next Queensland state election. It is a very big step, but the support for One Nation in Queensland is very, very strong, and I think the people out there are wanting a change as well in Queensland, so yes.
The New South Wales Transport Minister, Brian Langton, says he'll have a preliminary report within days on the cause of yesterday's freight train accident at Beresfield in the Hunter Valley. Two train drivers are recovering in hospital after the train slammed into another train, which had stopped near Beresfield Station yesterday morning. The wreckage has blocked all four rail lines, and one is expected to be cleared later today. Mr Langton says a full investigation is underway. The Russian Space Agency says the Mir orbital station will fall back to Earth and disintegrate in the lower atmosphere towards the end of 1999. It says Mir will be abandoned once the International Alpha Space Station becomes operational. The agency says once Mir enters the atmosphere, it will burn up before reaching the ground. ABC News.
You're with us on ABC Classic FM. 11:05 is the time. It's 1 hour later if you're listening in Tasmania. And Haydn is our composer of the week. We have a symphony a little bit later, the Symphony No. 104, the London, and probably, oh, I was going to say his all-time most favourite or most famous or most familiar melody, which is in fact attributed to Haydn, the famous serenade from the string quartet in F, in the middle. But we'll start with a divertimento. This has a lovely, lovely adagio. Divertimento No. 9 in G. Thank you.